Hey, and welcome to Foolproof Theology. I'm Chase Davis, and I'm your host. It's great to be with you. Today on the episode, we've got Dr. Patrick Downey. Patrick, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Oh, my pleasure. Glad to be here.
So we're going to talk about your work, Serious Comedy. But before we get into that, I thought it might be useful both for me and our listeners to try to get some more information about your background. You're out at St. Mary's in California. You've got a PhD. What was kind of your journey to where you are now, being a kind of a professor in a philosophy department at a Catholic university? How did you get to where you are today?
Well, my background is Southern California, part of the Jesus movement as a young kid. But I was kind of a strange kid. I was reading Pascal. I remember reading that on the beach, some Bible study, beach party. And so that got me interested in philosophy. And so I've always been trying to relate philosophy to my Christian faith. Mm. And so I went to Claremont undergraduate, and then I went to Harvard Divinity School, kind of the hotbed of liberal solution to this. And I wasn't satisfied with that at all. But I got a good education there. But I was focused in on the Bible. I had a good background in the Bible from Chuck Smith, just kind of going through it every day, every church meeting. So I think I internalized a good reading of scripture. And I wasn't getting it academically, so I had to kind of do it on my own. And so then when I went to Boston College and worked in the systematic theology program, that was my chance to put it all together. And so the book Serious Comedy is my kind of put everything but the kitchen sink in one book, trying to relate all the things that was going on in my mind, and I hope I organize them well. But finally, it's the question of Athens or Jerusalem, which one do you really have to take the most seriously? And sure. The key thing is, how does one understand scripture? That's kind of the pivot point. Okay. Serious Comedy is my account. The Bible is a comedy, but a serious comedy.
Right.
And so all the implications of that relative to Athens and Jerusalem.
That's great. Okay. Well, I look forward to hearing more about that. When you were at, you said you got your PhD out at Harvard, or where did you say?
I got my master's at Harvard Divinity School. Okay. And then my PhD at Boston College.
Boston College. And what was your PhD in philosophy?
No, it was in theology.
Oh, was it? Okay,
cool. But it was systematic foundational theology. So it was right on the edge of philosophy. So when I went out to get a job, I could say I was either going to teach philosophy or theology. So I ended up getting a job teaching philosophy.
That's great.
Yeah.
What was it like? I mean, that's a wild journey. Just I'm thinking in my mind of other men I've met, other people I've met coming from the Jesus movement. Mm-hmm. to where you went, where God has placed you now. Mm-hmm. When you look back at that time in the Jesus movement, do you have a lot of appreciation for how God was working in your life during that time? I've heard all these stories, like it was like hippie church and like everybody's on the beach. What was it like to be part of that movement back in the day?
Yeah. Actually, here there's a movie coming out about it called Jesus Revolution, which is basically, it was filmed during the time that I was there, a little kid getting baptized in Pirates Cove and Corona Del Mar. So I was intrigued to see that they're making a movie of that. But I was really lucky to be part of that, just because, as I mentioned, I think I got a solid background in scripture, somebody that took it very seriously. That was the whole MO of Chuck Smith, is just to go through scripture, not really to preach sermons at all, but to work through it. And so I was actually, and then later on when I learned it academically, I didn't realize I was getting a profound orientation in the old way of reading scripture prior to the Enlightenment, that was kind of being revived in the Yale School of Theology and places that were nearby where I was. And so I just kind of had a leg up on things that a lot of other people just weren't familiar with. I knew them instinctively in my bones at a young age. But then, of course, it wasn't intellectually satisfying because they just were non-philosophical at all. They had no clue about philosophical issues. But once you know those, you can't get them out of your head.
Right.
And so it's always been exciting to reconcile the two, to have this profound account of philosophy that I learned finally at Boston College, and to see, well, yeah, this is the most complementary approach to the reading of scripture I had at a young age.
Yeah.
They actually complement each other at the highest level.
I think that's a great story of God's providence. And I have a similar kind of background as well. So I really appreciate how God has worked in that way. Well, your book, Serious Comedy, from what I understand, it came out in 2001. Mm-hmm. And then this is you recently did a reprint of it. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah. Reprint with two new chapters, the introduction with Colin Redimer. And then I added another chapter to it on the nature of just reading books in general.
Okay, cool. Was there a lot when I, because I've never done that, gone back 20 years, unless I have a journal from the time I was a teenager or something. Right, but yeah. When you revisited the work, was there a lot of like, yes, this still sticks, this still works, I'm very confident, and or did you have to do a lot of rewriting and reworking of the material?
Oh, no. It was nice to reread it. It's like, wow, I used to be kind of an intelligent guy back in the past. I had a lot in my head that all, you know, hung together. And now I have little pieces of it and they don't. So I was just happy it's out there. I didn't want to monkey with it. I'm not really in a position to deal with it. I don't quite have the on top of it mindset I had back then.
That's funny. Yeah. Well, in your work series comedy, you said, I'm just going to read a quote here from it that I found really interesting. Because of the Bible, we inherit the expectation that we can live serious lives in writing, but because we no longer believe in the one divine poet who could make this possible, the joke is always on us, for we can no longer take our own comedies seriously. Mm-hmm. Could you unpack that for me a little bit? Because I think I understand mm-hmm. what it's getting at there, what mm-hmm. we're talking about, but could you tell me more about that?
Sure. Well, to back up a bit, you need to contrast comedy with tragedy.
Okay.
So in tragedy, you're in a dark, it's like what we see in a theater. You're in a theater, you don't look at each other, you look at the stage. Okay. And so you forget yourself and you think the world is up on stage. We'll probably come back to that, but contrast it with comedy. In the Greeks, you have this classic comedy where the poet pulls aside the curtain, breaks the fourth wall, and addresses you, the audience, and says, I hope you're going to like my jokes. I wrote them to entertain you. You smart people will get the good jokes. You not so smart people will get kind of the dumb jokes, but you're all going to be entertained. And so by breaking that fourth wall, the audience realizes that the comedy is made for their benefit and it's artificial. It's not reality. It's just a device for them to enjoy themselves.
Sure.
And so you can't take it seriously, in other words, because you know you're in on the joke. You're gotcha. Manufacturing it with the person doing it. So when you have a happy ending, you kind of know, well, I paid money to show up here and enjoy a happy ending. So I want my money's worth.
Yeah.
But you don't think it's really a happy ending. It's only that sentimental within the confines of the artistic work that it's happy.
Yeah.
Well, so, what happened, we go back into this, but after Dante, and Machiavelli, tragedy dropped out. We can't take tragedy seriously. We're too self-reflective. We're aware that we're turning everything into a joke. And so we know we can't take seriously our artistic productions. We know they're kind of, so to speak, artificial and fake.
Yeah.
But we can't take tragedy seriously anymore, which seem to be real, but we don't think it's real. So the problem is we don't have any world that we can create that we think, yeah, this is real and true, rather than just an expression of my desires, which means it's kind of phony. And so that's why we can't take our comedies seriously. We'd like to take them seriously because we know there's a human poet behind it who's co-conspiring with us to be pleased.
Yeah.
So the only possibility that you could take a comedy seriously would be if the poet behind it is not some human poet like us that's just making something to please us, but would be God himself, the God who made all of nature independent of anything made, who made nature rather than artifice. If he's the author of this comic poem, then you can take it seriously because the author that peeps behind the curtain, breaks the fourth wall, is not a human author, but God himself. Then and only then can you take a comedy seriously. And then you can have a happy ending and think this is really a happy ending, not only for within the confines of this artifice thing, but because God's the poet of this poem, then it's a happy ending in reality, independent of the poem.
That's helpful. Thanks so much for clarifying. So you would suggest that the Bible as a category would be serious comedy. What do people read the Bible as tragedy, though? In what way do we see the Bible as tragedy?
Well, they can read it as tragedy. Well, they find it very hard to read it as tragedy. What they have to turn it into is kind of the history behind it or something like that. And then they bring in kind of a philosophical account of tragedy independent of the poem. You see that in a lot of existential theology the last 100 years or in higher critical things. But basically, the Bible can't be read as a tragedy anymore either. It doesn't seem to work that way. People like to do it, but nobody's really pulled it off reading it like a tragedy. It just doesn't admit of the tragic property. You're too aware of what's going on between you and the text for it to be tragic. You're too self-reflective, in other words, to view it tragically.
And would you say that this self-reflectiveness, when did it, was it a movement in philosophical history? Was it, what brought that on, our inability mm-hmm. to, or maybe our obsession with mm-hmm. kind of this, I call it personally, just as a person, as a Christian, as a man, mm-hmm. I have this kind of side of my spirituality because of how I was raised or how our world is framed, mm-hmm. where I'm obsessive a little bit over my motives, over why I do what I do, over how mm-hmm. I present myself, and mm-hmm. almost like this narcissism, mm-hmm. To use a kind of a hot word today. But mm-hmm. where did this kind of obsession with self-introspection and self-reflectiveness come from?
Right. Yeah. Well, in one sense, it came from the Bible. But it's the Bible where people no longer believe in God. So they still have the kind of the comic habit of the Bible, but without God as a poet. And so another way of looking at comedy is if they break the fourth wall and you see somebody on stage talking to you, then you think, well, maybe I myself am on a stage, and you look behind yourself and maybe someone looking at your life, and then you can look at them. And so that narcissism, that, you know, doubling back upon oneself, that self-reflective consciousness is itself a symptom of a comic understanding of the world. Wow. Where you can never get off a stage. Even if you think you're safely in an audience, you may yourself be up on the stage. Shakespeare's always using all the world's a stage. Well, that's that. So what you want to do is, I wish I could anchor, have an audience that just stays put, and then the reality's on stage. But the problem is, you're so self-aware that you can never get rid of that doubt that you yourself are on stage. So tragedy is the attempt to position the audience and make it stay, but then forget itself, to not be self-reflective. So philosophers have tried to do that. Nietzsche and Heidegger, for one, they want tragedy. They lust after tragedy. Hegel did also, but they can't do it. They always kind of become self-reflective, self-aware, and they you can see the white knuckle grip trying to turn the world into a tragic place, but they all fail. And because that self-reflectiveness always creeps back up. They can't forget themselves, in other words.
Yeah, it's almost like it's hardwired into us to be that way. It's part of being human, is that capacity to reflect upon oneself, whether however well or, you know, not well one does that. But that mm-hmm. that I just remember being a kid. I don't know if you ever had these thoughts, maybe because you were into philosophy as well, but I would lay in bed at night and I would think, mm-hmm. why was I born in this mm-hmm. time and this place and not in that time and that place? Mm-hmm. And I would just, like, back in the day when, you know, I don't have a TV in my room, and I would just lay there for like an hour thinking, like, mm-hmm. what would it be like to be born? Mm-hmm. And now I have a dog in the house, and I don't think my dog's ever had a thought like that.
Exactly.
But it's kind of in our nature as humans mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That God wired us that way. And what's mm-hmm. truly sad, whether we call it tragic or comic or however, mm-hmm. whatever word you would probably give it better, but it's as if without God, mm-hmm. it's constantly, I think Augustine called it curved inwards, or mm-hmm. we're constantly focused in on ourselves and trying to solve this puzzle of life. Mm-hmm. If we have no divine poet, like you say, mm-hmm. We can really get into some really nasty places of depression mm-hmm. or isolation or anger mm-hmm. because we can't figure out the puzzle. It's so complicated.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it's kind of a complicated thing within my book, but there's a distinction between your life being playful and serious. Mm. And so, but that's different than a poem being comic or tragic.
Okay.
And so the challenge is to take your life seriously, but then have some sort of narrative of your life that can be taken seriously. And so the serious comedy is, you actually can have a comedy that can allow you to take your life seriously. Whereas most of the narratives that are out there, they make it so it's almost impossible to take your life seriously. So you got to joke about yourself. There's always that ironic wink and that Seinfeldian, you know, joke. Your life is about nothing, and everybody's kind of noticed that. And the only way you can take yourself seriously and yet kind of have a playful way of talking about it would be in the serious comedy of the Bible.
Yeah, I think I see this in a lot of preaching too, and I'm tempted to, especially when I was a young preacher, this kind of self-deprecation. Oh, I'm not that smart, or you know, I don't know what I'm talking about, and making jokes about your life and kind of diminishing your office as a pastor.
Right.
And I think it's a, I don't know if it would be an attempt to try to connect with people or however you might put it, but there seems to be a widespread interest in kind of this, whether it's like Seinfeld or The Office, where we don't take anything seriously.
Right.
So what would be a better way? Is the better way to position yourself, knowing that self-reflection is inevitable, that you are just a human, you're a limited, finite creature, and yet there are really serious things about life that we need to discuss. What would be a better way to kind of frame maybe a young minister, a young pastor who's thinking, gosh, how do I be honest with people? And yet, how do I also kind of take my office seriously, take my work seriously without becoming kind of this jokester that's constantly self-effacing?
Well, you kind of put it by, how do you take your role seriously? That's, you know, an image from a theater. So you are playing a role and you're on stage, but if finally that stage you're on is the stage that God made, that he's the one that set up the whole stage, beginning, middle, and end. He's the one that authored the plot, and he's the main character in the plot, but he's also the guy that authored the plot. Then you have your office, you have your role relative to that plot. And so you always kind of know what you should be doing relative to that plot. And you can take that plot seriously. So you don't have to say, oh, well, can I live up to my role? Because you didn't make your role. You didn't author your role. It was authored for you. And so you can trust the author that he gives you the office, and that your office is seriously not because you can uphold it from within. So you can conform and show that you deserve that office. Mm. You always see it triangulating through the author of the office. But then he's on stage with you because he performed that office well as the one that authored that office. And so that's why you can have complete confidence, even though you're fully self-aware that it is a role, but that's no problem, because this is different than a human making a role. This is a role made by God.
That's a great way to think of it. I think that'll be encouraging to a lot of people. And I know it frees oneself from having to either prove or, you know, perform in a way as if to legitimize oneself.
Yeah,
instead, the legitimization comes from the author of the role, the author of the drama. So I think that's a wonderful way to think of it. Something you talk about in your book that I'm really curious to hear more about is comedy and tragedy as kind of the foundation of political philosophy. And so when I was reading your book, it was interesting because, you know, I'm watching you kind of track through a lot of these big name philosophers, which is really fun because it's very comprehensive in that way. And yet there's this tinge of political philosophy from Plato and Aristotle. Can you talk to me a little bit about how comedy and tragedy are at the foundation of political philosophy?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mentioned earlier that idea of tragedy, you have the darkened theater where people forget themselves and they just look on stage.
Yeah.
Well, that's essentially tragedy that Plato and Aristotle both in their own way said that is the lie of the city. Huh. In other words, the city is founded on a lie. And the lie is that essentially on stage, you have some sort of scapegoat, you have Oedipus, you have your enemies. And they are the ones, because you see them on stage, you then can unite yourself and forget your divisions that you have and feel united by having all your divisions on stage. So this is kind of the medicinal lie, the pharmakon, the pharmakos of the city that the philosophers saw. And they knew the city was founded upon a lie. It needed this lie to function. Huh. But they, as philosophers, they, so to speak, got outside that cave of the tragic theater, and they saw that it was a lie because they saw nature that's totally different than that. And then they had to deal with the poets that created the world of the city, but then the philosopher's not quite the poets. So how did they deal with that? Plato, ironically, became a poet. He wrote the dialogues with Socrates as a character. But the difference was he's able to expose the lie of tragedy by writing comic poems. And so basically the ancient philosophers are in the business of writing comedy as an antidote to the lie of tragedy. And so, but that put them in tension with the city. Socrates got killed by Athens.
Right.
Aristotle almost did too, because they knew that what the philosopher's up to, he's a walking criticism of that lie that's so foundational to human politics. And so that's just the primordial quarrel between the philosopher and the poets that the philosopher started with. And so that led into all sorts of later philosophical traditions. But but it also basically the Christian narrative came in, same with Plato, and both of them undermine people's ability to take the lie seriously. Once you know that you're kind of lying to yourself, once you know a scapegoat is not really guilty, then you realize, well, I can't take myself seriously hidden away in this unified theater. And so both Christianity and philosophy in some way kind of undermine the seriousness of human politics. And so people didn't know what to do with it. And so a lot of philosophical traditions are trying to solve that without going to the Christian solution of a serious right. comedy, or they go to kind of the Platonic tradition, but then they don't live in a world that really takes the tragic lie seriously anymore. So the philosopher kind of loses his role too.
Yeah.
So it just has kind of a bad effect on both on Platonic philosophy and a bad effect on politics. Yeah. So politics and philosophy have been kind of limping ever since the Christianity came on the scene.
Would you say maybe put an illustration today, or if you can think of one, because in my mind, I'm trying to think, okay, I'm tracking with you, the city kind of being a lie. It's a tragedy. There's scapegoats. It reminds me a lot of Girard and kind of this mimetic desire type stuff. Mm-hmm. But how do you see that playing out today? I mean, we're both situated in the United States of America. You're in California. I'm in Colorado. Mm-hmm. What might be some examples that you could help people see that? The way, and I'll give you kind of one of my mm-hmm. illustrations I've been using, is that, you know, for people in my church, for people that I minister to, for friends, I'm like, the pressure you feel around having to like pick a side, or like mm-hmm. who you vote for and all this stuff, it mm-hmm. it's too much. It's not mm-hmm. healthy. It's not just from a spiritual level. Like mm-hmm. that's not right. how we're meant to live. But how mm-hmm. might you articulate mm-hmm. it for people to kind of like show an example mm-hmm. today?
Right. Yeah. Well, one way goes back to not just Girard, but also Schmidt, who had influence on Strauss and not so much Girard, but take it in terms of friends and enemies. That's really big with our world. The part of the lie of the ancient city with tragedy is that you needed enemies to have friends. You don't okay. start with friends and then discover your enemies. There's really an inversion going on that tragic theater brings out. You need your enemies on stage to then feel like you're friendly with the audience. Okay, we kind of do the same sort of thing, that we need our enemies to feel unified as friends. And then but the problem is we Christianity's undermined that whole distinction, because you're supposed to love your enemies. So right. we can't take it that seriously. It gets undermined. And then all of a sudden, we'll have new enemies. But we're always trying to get our enemies to develop friendship. Well, the challenge of Christians is to develop friendship independent of enemies.
Right.
And so that's why Christ is the one who's authoring this way of seeing ourselves, where we can now be friends with everybody. And by being friends with everybody, then we don't need enemies to be friends, and we can cultivate this friendship. And enemies don't threaten us, nor do they give us ourselves. They just are kind of not part of the mix at all. We don't really need to think of the world in terms of enemies at all. Even if our enemies are crucifying us, like with Christ, the whole world became yeah. his enemy. And yet at the very moment, he was loving us while we were yet enemies. And so then if we see ourselves the way he looked at the world, there are no enemies, and enemies don't give meaning to your life at all. If they do, you're missing something significant. You're trying to reproduce the tragic lie, but it's never going to work, because we see through it all the time. It kind of falls apart. So it's a fool's errand anyway. So just give up on enemies, give up on victims, scapegoating. This is not going to illumine the world. You have to see Christ as the victim of his enemies, but then you see everybody as your friend.
Yeah, I've found that personally really helpful when, like, there was a guy, just a practical example. There was a guy who we were kind of going back and forth on Twitter. Turns out he lives near me. And mm-hmm. so I reached out to him and I was like, hey, we should get lunch. And so, mm-hmm. you know, in a depersonalized, dehumanizing social media mm-hmm. interaction, it's mm-hmm. easy to categorize everyone right. as, are you with me or against me? But then right, you break bread with somebody in real life and it's like, yeah, mm-hmm. like, it's just not. I mean, mm-hmm. I can love this person, even if we disagree about some stuff, I can still love them, mm-hmm. move towards them in generosity and Christ-like love. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's yeah. really effective in a secular context, like where I am in Boulder, where mm-hmm. people have a lot of suspicions about Christ, Christianity, Christians, mm-hmm. Their impact in the world. And when you just meet them and you say, well, I'm a Christian, and all of a sudden they're like, they're both on the one hand horrified. You know, I've had people walk away from me as soon as they hear that I'm a pastor. Uh-huh. But on the other hand, if people will just kind of be there and see that you're human and you're friendly and you genuinely love them and want the best for them, it can really have a profound impact in bringing the love of Christ to people. So I think that's a really helpful way. Schmidt, you mentioned Schmidt, and he's the one that kind of came up with this friend enemy distinction. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's actually there in Plato. I mean, Plato's okay. very aware of this, so it's an old thing that's in the tradition. He's just the guy that made it his little hobby horse, and it tied it into, you know, legal and political issues in the 20th century.
Do you think it's a helpful paradigm to think through the friend enemy distinction when we're thinking about politics, or do you think that as Christians, it's it may have something, but ultimately it's not how we should be thinking?
Oh, no, the whole thing is to overcome it. In other words, the friend-enemy distinction is the tragic lie, or in Christian terms, it is the foundation of sin.
Okay.
If that insofar as you need enemies to be friends, that's what sin is. And so in one sense, Adam and Eve kind of made God their enemy when they're listening to the serpent. And so God is trying to keep them from the knowledge of good and evil. So then he became their enemy. Then they covet what he has. And then they thought they could develop a friendship based on God as their enemy. So envy, coveting, that's the heart of Christian sin. So that's why the friend and enemy distinction is just coveting at a highest political level. But it's also why that kind of politics is a lie. I mean, that's why Schmidt's kind of tied in with the Nazis, because that was, along with Nietzsche and Heidegger, they're desperate to get that friend-enemy distinction back and take it seriously, because it would give so much more meaning to their life, to their nation, whatever. And of course, it's going to be a failure. It's just not going to work. But it was kind of a atheistic attempt to bring back. Again, it's that lust after tragedy when you can't believe your tragic stories anymore. So nobody believes this stuff. They knew they're lying to themselves, in other words, when they did this. But when you know you're lying to yourself, your lies don't work. That's the problem.
Yeah. So what might be a better way, if we're thinking politically, just for a moment, if we're thinking politically about people who are utterly opposed to one's way of life, you know, and maybe even me saying that is me giving in to the tragedy, you know, mindset. Well, what might be a better way to bring in a Christian perspective to kind of how we perceive of people who are secular, atheistic, you know, are promoting policies and agendas that run contrary to human flourishing? What might be a better way to frame, I mean, obviously comedy, I would assume you would probably suggest that, but like how should we move away from a friend-enemy distinction when it does feel like there are a lot of enemies out there? What's a better way to conceive of that?
Yeah. Well, I'm kind of working on this right now. I'm working on a book on called Blood of the Nations, on nations, which is kind of neglected when we read the Bible. But because nations, quite often, we are a nation because we have our enemy nations. Okay, and then you think of a boundary as the boundary has friends on this side, enemies on that side. But I think Scripture brings out that the nation of Israel is chosen by God to bless all the nations of the world. And so that means you have a nation, but it's related to the other nations, not as in terms of friends and enemies. And so one has to then rethink through the scriptural account and see that, yeah, there are boundaries between people. There are even nations. There are us and them, but it's not a conflictual relationship. It's a way that you share precisely with that boundary there. The same way that you have skin that separates you from other people. Right. But that doesn't mean people outside your skin are your enemies and you're your friend. The whole idea of the body of Christ is you keep your skin, but you somehow transcend skin because through Christ's body. And all these distinct bodies share in each other as long as you transcend to the God who gave you your body and your skin. And so then one has to keep your eye on that transcendent mode and keep your eye on the resurrection of the dead and resurrection of bodies. And likewise, there'll be kind of this final consummation of the nations that Israel will bless all the nations, as you see in the New Jerusalem. Then there won't be any enemies at all, but there will be distinctions, very big distinctions. And yet you want the distinctions to be there and not a threat to you.
Right. That's helpful. Thanks for sharing about that. The topic of tragedy as kind of fear and pity mixed together, and how at the end of a tragedy, Well, before I ask this, maybe it would be helpful. Like, what is there an example that you can think of, whether it's a movie or a book in the last 30 years, that might be a good example of a tragedy if people wanted to kind of like pinpoint, because we've talked about The Office or Seinfeld or something like that, which I thoroughly enjoy Seinfeld. I think it's very interesting. My dad used to fall asleep watching Seinfeld growing up. But what might be a good example of tragedy that people could go like, okay, I understand that.
Yeah, I mean, that's, in one sense, that's part of my thesis. There aren't any good examples. we kind of fake it, but we don't quite believe in our tragedies. I mean, you see movies attempting to do it. Like, I'm dating myself, but the movie Gallipoli, or the end of Unforgiven, of Clint Eastwood.
Yeah.
This is back in the day when I saw movies, back these old movies. But you have, like at Gallipoli, you have a guy going over the trenches, and he's running, and you know he's going to die, and then he gets shot, and then the frame ends. So it's a death that's kind of meaningless, but it's the spectacle of that death that seems to, wow, and you just sit there in the eye, and you go, wow, that's heavy. Okay, but you have no idea what that's heavy means, or that's profound. It's because it's the spectacle itself. But then you walk out of the theater and the spell's broken.
Okay? Right.
So that's why tragedy doesn't work. But we'd like to have that where we just sit and look at the world and we say, wow, that's profound. I've seen the worst. And yet somehow I find this strange sort of cathartic pleasure in having seen the worst. So it's hard for movies to do that, but you see a lot of people trying to do it. And that's what tragedy used to do. You'd see Oedipus and just terrible things that happened. And you'd go, wow, that was kind of the most meaningful thing I've seen. And if somebody would say, why was that meaningful? I don't know, because that's just kind of Oedipus is everybody. You know, we've seen ourselves. But what you forget is that you've seen Oedipus, but by seeing him, you've kind of distanced yourself, but you can't notice that. You've kind of seen this, but it is on stage. In one sense, you've forgotten it in yourself because you've seen it on stage. So you're not really Oedipus anymore when you see Oedipus, the tragic story. Right. But that transformation happens behind your back and you don't notice it.
Yeah.
But once you bring it around in front of yourself, then it doesn't work anymore. Because then you say, well, yeah, I'm Oedipus. And if you really become reflective that I'm Oedipus and I'm the same guy on stage, then you don't get a release from being Oedipus. You're still Oedipus and you're, we won't use the word for what you are, but you're not happy with it. Yeah. It doesn't solve your problem. And so So we don't really have that solution. We wish we could somehow see our worst and yet be relieved of it, but we never get relieved of it.
And does that kind of go back to the scapegoat mentality where it's like, if I can see something happen to someone else, that's tragic, that's bad, that somehow that emotional catharsis is going to be a type of soothing narrative that I can go like, well, I've seen really bad things. And therefore, you know, either how would you identify, like, what is the root of that desire to see that or that emotional catharsis? How would you describe that?
Yeah. Well, this is where I'm kind of in the weeds with a debate with a lot of accounts of tragedy. But my argument, and going back to Aristotle, I think pity and fear are both painful emotions. Because when you pity somebody, you say, oh, it's terrible that happened to so-and-so, but it could happen to me. And so there's a certain pain involved in that. Same with fear. You see them fearing something, you say, well, if that could happen to me, and that would be painful too. Okay, but why would you go into a theater to see painful things? Well, it's because by seeing them, it actually gets transmuted into a pleasure, and that's catharsis. So you're trying to expel those painful passions of pity and fear. In modern, a lot of modern contemporary thinkers like Martha Nussbaum, et cetera, they argue that pity and fear are actually things you want to cultivate. You want to have pity because we think pity is kind of a good thing. But pity always means that you're kind of, you have a distance from the person you're pitying. You're kind of glad you're not suffering the person you pity. You're kind of condescending to the people you pity. So it actually cuts you off from people. But if you add catharsis to it, then pity doesn't cut you off. You can see it, what you pity, but then not be cut off. But it's a deceitful thing. Well, now we think pity and fear is a good thing, but that's because we're always trying to do that. I want to somehow look down on people and it makes me feel better, but then you got to keep doing it. And it doesn't actually unite people. It always makes it, you feel good as long as you're slightly above the person you're pitying.
Right.
That's why so much of kind of do-goodism that we have in our secular culture is just a way of kind of feeling better about oneself, medicating oneself by a slight condescension towards all these ills in the world. Right. Again, it's trying to be tragic, but without a artistic thing that can pull it off and make it work. We just have this emotions that we've got to reproduce again and again and again.
Yeah, that's powerful. It reminds me of, so when I was a teenager, I used to joke that I was one of those emo kids. I never went full and had like all some of them put on like makeup and all this stuff, but I was really into sad music, you know, and I really enjoyed sad music. In fact, it was right before COVID. I went to a concert, and who knows if it was at the concert, but we were all there, and it was one of those artists that was more emo, and man, it was just so fun. Yeah. And part of me wonders how much of that is rooted in that desire to be like, he's in a lot of pain. Or he's singing songs that are really painful. And maybe I can identify with some of them, but it's almost this cathartic feeling when you leave.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
This therapeutic feeling when you hear those songs of tragedy, that it can lead to yourself feeling distanced.
Well, that's probably the best example. We don't really see it in theater, but the sad songs in my class, that's my go-to example, is you just broke up with your girlfriend. What do you want to listen to? Sad songs, whether it be country or emo. Okay, why do you want to double your sadness to hear a song about the very sadness you don't enjoy feeling? You don't realize it, but actually that artistic artifact of the song, by it, so to speak, feeling the sadness, you then find pleasure in that. But you don't notice the pleasure you're feeling. You're noticing the sad song. So you're reproducing the effects that tragedy used to have. But you're kind of being self-forgetful. You don't really... you're not knowing more about yourself when you hear a sad song. In one sense, you're knowing less because you forget yourself. It's all based on self-forgetfulness.
Fascinating. Boy, I've got a lot of I've got a lot to think about in terms of my own story. That's really helpful though. I think, you know, one way I put it in my life is like, and I think my wife and I are different in this way maybe, is that when I'm feeling sad, I think some people are like, well, what can I do to either counteract the sadness, because I think most humans, you know, don't want to feel sad. It's not something that's like, I'm going to choose to feel sad today. But I think for a lot of people when they're feeling sad or down, they want to listen to upbeat music or like, you know, the perfect example is like Christian radio where it's positive, encouraging. And man, when I feel sad or angry and I turn on Christian radio, it just makes me even more angry. Like I don't get encouragement. It puts me in more of a funk. And so a lot of times our interaction with music seems to be very rooted in like, how can I listen to music that mimics my, my state of being and my emotional state. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah. 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 And I would say that the reason this upbeat music gets you irritated is it actually makes you feel your pain directly.
Okay.
In other words, you're just aware of your pain. It is yours. Cause whatever I'm hearing on that, you know, is not making me forget myself. It's making me aware of myself. And now being aware of yourself is not a pleasant feeling. It's a painful feeling. So it makes you actually suffer more pain. But if you hear the pain on your song, then you can forget your pain. It's no longer your pain. It's in the in that artifact, in that poem, so to speak.
That's fascinating. That's really helpful. Thanks for kind of going there with me. The last character I wanted to talk about in the book is Machiavelli. I haven't studied Machiavelli. And so I believe he wrote The Prince. I wanted to better understand Machiavelli because sometimes people get characterized as Machiavellian. Who was Machiavelli? What was kind of his big idea? And when people describe others as Machiavellian, what does that mean?
Well, it's a complicated question. He's the guy I'd say that founded modernity. He's what made philosophy modern. He talked about doing new modes and orders. He was going to be like a Columbus that was going to sail and discover a new world of intellectual thought. Because he's right around the same time Columbus discovered the new world. And so what's the new world for Machiavelli? It's turning your back on the old world, which would be essentially Plato and Aristotle and the Bible, and coming with a new world. And in the new world, it would be where you would artificially solve your political problems and know what you're doing. In other words, he thought I call it the technological comedy of modernity. If you know what you're doing, you can actually solve your political problems deliberately if you have the right techniques. So it's all about a technique. He has the image of that fortune is like a woman You can't trust fortune. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. So you're out of control. What you want is control. So what you need is to be a young man, modern. You need to pick up a stick and beat Lady Fortuna and make her submit to your will. And so the stick is modernity. You've got to develop the stick by which to beat Mother Nature, basically mm-hmm. Lady Fortuna, and then make her submit to you. And then if you get her to submit to you, then you can tell her what to do rather than her telling you. So that's why so much of modernity is technologically oriented towards mastery and control. And Machiavelli's the guy that set that going politically, but then it was applied to science with Bacon, applied to politics with Hobbes, applied to all sorts of things. But he's the guy that kind of got that focus on technique and control and mastery going.
And so before Machiavelli kind of posited these ideas, was there less interest in terms of either controlling nature and trying to find techniques to kind of order the world rightly? Was it less obsessed with that? And if so, what was its orientation? How was its orientation different?
Yeah, so both of the Christian philosophical scene of Augustine and others, and also Plato and Aristotle, your mode towards Mother Nature was theoria. You would view her like a beautiful woman that you're just happy to look at her and see how beautiful she was. You wouldn't think you could ever master or control her. You just were happy to see her, to know her. And so that wasn't based on mastery. Where when you get to Machiavelli, you don't want to see her and know her. You want to control her and beat her and make her do your bidding. And so that's the big shift towards control rather than knowing. It's from knowledge to mastery, from seeing and this blissful seeing. And that would also then finally, you want to see God. That would be the beatific vision. Your heaven for Christians is to see God and know him the way he's known you. Well, that was all rejected because now even your relationship to God, you only care about God if you can somehow get him to do your bidding and make him work for you. And so you want that, and that's the serpent's temptation. You want to master God. You want to make him do your bidding. Idolatry would be forms of that as well.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's really helpful. Well, this was really helpful for me personally. And I know if it was helpful for me personally, it's going to be helpful for other people as well. I want to make sure I can point people to the right places to get more of your content, hear more of your stuff. Obviously, they can roll at St. Mary's and go study under you. where could they pick up your book, Serious Comedy?
It's published by Davenant Press, and you can also get it on Amazon.
Okay.
And then also have a book, Desperately Wicked, that kind of applies a lot of these arguments to the philosophers and theological things. So that's kind of a popularized version of this, which is more kind of scholarly, serious comedy. And then wait for my Blood in the Nations that will come out. Who knows when, but
sure.
That should be out next 5 years, I hope. Yeah,
that's great. Do you have a website I can point people to?
No.
That's
I'm
great.
Too low tech to have a website.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, I respect that a lot. Well, yeah. If you're
I was lucky to get on here and get all my stuff wired up here.
Sure. If you're a listener and you want to hear more or read more, go pick up one of these works and look forward to his next work coming out. Patrick, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Enjoyed it.
Hey, if you're a listener and you enjoyed this content, I'd love it if you shared it with somebody else. Sign up for the Patreon in the link in the description of this episode. That way you can interact with me. You can suggest new guests to have on the show, other topics you want me to cover. And it helps me bring great content like this to you. It's a very low budget podcast we've got here, but it does have a budget. It's just low, but I need all the help I can get. And so if you're a fan of the show, you want to share it with others, that'd be great. And also sign up at the Patreon. Anyway, we will see you next time.